The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, today we talk to Robert Higgs, who continues the discussion about this punctuated growth in government. But I think something that really hit me more when I read his book, Crisis and Leviathan, was that he pointed out that, 100 years ago, the federal government virtually had no presence in people's lives. But now, it's the new norm. And he talks about ideology and the ideology of the people and how it changes as this Leviathan grows to where we accept something that's unsustainable in the long run.
Kevin, that's very reminiscent of sort of that 2008 period to present, where we have seen a transition in ideology.
Yeah.
And I think people are very open today to the idea of a ratcheting forward of government. We need more, not less, because they haven't done enough to keep us safe, quote unquote. Now, what's interesting from just a purely economic perspective is the government's gone from being 7% of GDP. If you're looking at, just an economic measure of the size of government relative to our economy, they make up 7% of GDP 100 years ago.
Right.
And today they make up over 40%. So it's not as if they're uninvolved in our lives. It's not as if the postman is the only person that we see on a rare occasion. Kevin, it's a pervasive presence, and as I think we'll find in talking with Robert Higgs, there is this ability to ratchet forward on the basis of economic crisis and on the basis of war. Just a little background on Robert. He received his PhD in economics from Johns Hopkins and then taught at a variety of universities, Seattle University, University of Washington, Lafayette College, University of Economics in Prague, visiting scholar at both Oxford and Stanford. And so when he's talking about this, he's usually talking to a very academic audience.
Right.
And we've got some questions that I think will dig into some of the meat, the economic and political meat of the changes that are afoot here in the U.S.
Well, and you would really highly recommend, I'm sure, to the listener to read at least Crisis and Leviathan and probably the book that you're holding right now, Depression, War, and Cold War, for a person to understand how this actually affects them and their lives right now.
Absolutely. As many of our listeners are probably familiar by now, we like to take a very interdisciplinary approach. And when an author can bridge the gaps between fields, in this case, politics and economics, it's a great benefit. We would do that work ourselves, but here it's been done and served up on a silver platter, as it were. So I look at the book Crisis and Leviathan as a critical contribution, something you probably do want on your library shelves.
Well, David, let's go ahead and listen in on that conversation that you had with Robert Higgs right now.
In the context of 20th century history, there's an unsustainable trend of government growing more or less on an exponential basis, and that's at the expense of private sector interests. This is economic in nature. It's also political in nature. It includes things like the welfare state, eventually squeezing out privately directed associations, charities that, 100 years ago on a voluntary basis did those same things. Now the state does that. Private initiatives are less important than state initiatives and ultimately federal initiatives in the areas of welfare relief, training, medical care, and these things. Business and industry have likewise been squeezed to the margins of the economy, and this has happened on an aggressive basis at particular points in history. Our conversation today centers on the ratcheting higher of government involvement as a share of the total economy, essentially the footprint of government in this great land of ours. We've discussed some of these issues between ourselves, Kevin and I. Want to bring Robert Higgs into this conversation. He studied on these issues, taught on these issues, written on these issues for many years, many decades, in fact. Robert, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, knowing that you've taught courses lasting months on the issues that we want to discuss today, maybe you can distill the essence of the issues that you think are important, the nature of the state, and what we can expect to see as it operates and perhaps grows in this particular period of crisis.
Well, what I've discovered in studying especially the past century or century and a half, particularly in the United States, but not only in the United States, is the growth of the state is not a smooth, gradual process. If we look back at some time in the past, say 100 years ago, we'll see that the dimensions of the state are vastly smaller than they are now in almost every way we can imagine. The state, of course, is a multidimensional entity. It has all kinds of functions and operations and attributes. But regardless of how we think about the state, we find it much smaller a century ago than it is now in the United States and in all the advanced industrial economies of the world, for that matter. And when we ask, how did it get from A to B, how did it get from this much smaller condition to its present condition, we find that experienced a number of discrete lurches rather than simply following smooth growth curve. And these lurches are all associated with well-known periods of national emergency. And those emergencies have taken various forms, but the two predominant ones are economic emergencies, such as the Great Depression of the 1930s, and wars, especially the world wars. Those were overwhelmingly the most important events in this process. But we can see similar patterns of national emergency spurts and the growth of government associated with a number of other major emergency episodes in our history and in the histories of other countries when similar growth of the state took place. So this is a process by which we've arrived at our present condition. And what I've found is that although some students of the growth of government tend to think about these emergency spurts as abnormal, they are like outliers in some statistical pattern and ought to be ignored, I believe that it's just the other way around, that in fact they were decisive because when they occurred, they all passed away, of course, eventually. We're in one right now, which has yet to pass away, but we can fairly assume that sooner or later it will subside and will no longer be in a recognizable period of crisis. But whenever these crisis periods subside, they do not leave things the way they were before. They particularly leave conditions for the state different than they were before. And in the past century, the net result's always been to leave the state larger, more powerful, with a bigger scope than it had before, and in the process change people's ways of thinking about the state. One of the things that's a little different about my study of the state from other people's study is that I've put a lot of work into understanding the role of ideology, people's belief systems about social and political affairs, and how they changes in ideology have acted to constrain the state in a way, but also gradually to give more and more scope for the operation of the state.
Robert, maybe you could describe the ideological changes which have made the acceptance of a larger government easier to come into play.
If we went back a century, we would find the state in this country, as I say, very small. Government spending at all levels was about 7% of GDP, 7 or 8%. It's now in the neighborhood of 40%.
40, that's 40.
Yes. And so by that one measure, the government has grown 7 or 8-fold. I think that actually understates the extent to which government has grown. And 100 years ago, a normal person had virtually no contact with the federal government. As you saw, the postal delivery man, and that was about it. You didn't have any Social Security check in your mail. You didn't have to obey wages and hours laws if you ran a business. You didn't have to even pay income tax because there was no federal income tax in 1912. So the role of the state was much less, and so people thought about the federal government very differently, and they also thought about the state and local government somewhat differently, too. And in general, their way of thinking about it was that it's good to keep government small because politicians are crooks, and you can't trust them. And if they said they were going to do something, they wouldn't know how. So people thought about the government not as a horrible thing. That most people thought there ought to be a government and it ought to do certain essential tasks, but at the same time they thought it was very dangerous to let the government get much bigger than it was, because you would be handing affairs over to crooks and to incompetents.
That seems to be something that softened during periods of crisis, where actually the invitation of government to do something, you know, wherein, as you describe, the normal ideology is that we can pretty much take care of ourselves,
yeah,
and we don't need you involved,
right,
except in a crisis, and maybe it's sort of a pain threshold. You reach a certain degree or intensity of pain, and all of a sudden it's out of control, and you just want someone or something to restore control. Is that more or less?
In a way, I relate it mainly to fear. Periods of great national emergency are periods in which the general population becomes extremely afraid of something that they weren't so afraid of before. Suddenly, a foreign enemy poses a great threat. In wartime, in an economic breakdown, suddenly people are very fearful about their livelihood, the survival of their businesses, their ability to support their families in a way that they weren't fearful about before. So when people are very afraid, they get panicky, they don't know quite what to do because conditions are unusual, they're not sure how to cope, they look for a savior. And politicians always then rush into this situation offering themselves as saviors.
Let me just make a comment about this particular area in Crisis and Leviathan. I would recommend to any of our listeners with an interest in the topic to order a copy, and maybe you can tell folks where they should be able to do that, maybe just Amazon. But there's a section on ideology as an analytical concept where you go into the power of words and the use of rhetoric and the change in emotional tenor. There is a very subtle but powerful manipulative tool used by folks in political power to be that savior, to cast themselves as the enabler of great change, positive change. And you've looked at Lenin, he said that my words were calculated to evoke hatred, aversion, contempt, not to convince, but to break up the ranks of the opponent, not to correct an opponent's mistake, but to destroy him. And you get to that ideological side where language becomes an effective tool, whether you're casting yourself as a savior, but there's an openness, and the language is very important. I just can't say highly enough how important some of these sections are in your book, and I think very important for our listeners to key into.
Well, we all know that politicians speak a lingo of their own, and that political talk in general is a peculiar kind of talk. You could never say conduct business if you talk to your suppliers and your customers the way politicians talk to people, and in public the way they talk to each other. Of course, in private, they speak very differently. But they use this odd political language for a very good reason, to serve their own purposes and to basically misrepresent what they're actually doing. People need to understand that it's in the nature of the state as a coercive organization that preys upon the public and lives at the expense of the public, that state functionaries cannot be honest about what they're doing. So they have to always twist their attempts to serve their own purposes into a language of public service and of helping us. And over the centuries, a whole rhetoric of this kind has developed, and we hear it every time politicians open their mouths. But once we become sensitive to this use of language as a kind of weapon or device to deceive the listeners, we can, to some extent, shield ourselves from the effects of it. And people do get used to it. In a way, they tend to think of politicians as blowhards. But nonetheless, they still pay attention to them, and they don't disregard everything they say or really believe, in most cases, that everything they say is a lie. So they're still vulnerable to deception by state functionaries.
Let me ask you this, because, in the current context, I think everyone remembers Rahm Emanuel's statement a few years ago that you should never let a crisis go to waste.
Yes.
Where do you see the growth of government today And, you know, if crisis provides an extension of governmental powers, new powers in the fundamental sense, never being merely transitory, as you've said in your book, where do you see the growth of government, and what do you think the implications are? Can, from a fiscal standpoint, now being 40% of GDP, if there is to be greater growth in government over the next 5 to 10 years, how exactly do we afford that?
Well, of course, there's some limit. We can't continually increase the size, scope, and power of government because the predator will overwhelm the prey at some point. And what this will do in economic terms is it will crush the productive power of the private sector to create wealth and to increase wealth to the point that it becomes a crisis for the state to extract additional wealth for its own purposes. So there are limits, and we can perhaps see what some of them are by looking at European countries such as the Nordic countries, where government got very large, and in the case of Sweden, for example, which had probably the biggest state of any modern country, the Swedes have actually retrenched. They've had to back away from some of their state activities and cut down the size of their state a little bit, at least. So they may have been a kind of canary in the coal mine to tell us that you can get as big as Sweden did with your state, but probably not much bigger. If we look at countries where the state was all-encompassing, like the centrally planned economies in the Soviet Union and China, we see that those were not viable, that they imploded. They broke down, collapsed under their own weight because of their inability to generate enough wealth to provide a growing income for people and improve the level of living of the masses. So we do know that the state can't grow forever, but right now I am fairly confident that the state can get bigger in this country and will. It's certainly grown abruptly in the past 4 years, and I don't think it's going to give back all of that growth. The ratchet will operate here in the same way it's operated in previous crises, I'm sure, because every time you increase the size of the state, you not only make the state itself more powerful and give a greater advantage to state functionaries in fending off resistance, but you also co-opt various people in the private sector by cutting them into benefits that the government doles out. And this means that they feel they have a stake in this enlarged government, and they will fight retrenchment. So it's very difficult to reduce the size of the state after it has abruptly grown a great deal. And that explains what I call the ratchet phenomenon in past national emergencies.
There's an issue here with some confusion as to sort of a pure market economy and capitalism, which is perhaps in conflict with the business community at certain junctures. And I know that sounds even contradictory to say it, but in these periods of crisis where there's been greater regulation, it's not as if all business owners mind there being greater regulation. And maybe you can explore that, where in fact big business and something almost akin to corporatism can be a part of this growth of the state.
I would say that if you look at all the groups and the types of actors and interests that have contributed to the growth of the state over the past century and a half, a big business is the most important in causing the state to grow. There's a kind of myth that you've got government on one side and you've got the private sector on the other, and they're at war. But in fact, many of the actors in the seemingly private economy are far from pure private actors. They are people who receive all sorts of privileges and subsidies and assistance from the state and constantly seek to get more advantage from their connections with the state. So we've had in this country the development of a kind of participatory fascism, I call it. I borrowed that term from Charlotte Twight, but been using it for 40 years. Participatory fascism is like corporatism in the economic sense. It cuts a great many business interests into the deal. It gives them a stake. It encourages them to continually resort to the state rather than resorting to improving their products or their marketing or some other aspect of their private dealings. And by this time, the U.S. economy and most other modern economies, for that matter, are all corporatist systems. They're systems to which the state and many business interests are interpenetrated in ways that are so vast and hard to track down that it's hard to even appreciate this web of interrelationships that has developed.
Just a reminder, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com. McIlvaney.com.
Well, that idea of participatory fascism, the notion that somehow there is someone benefiting alongside the growth in government, it just says that regulations, which are very difficult for a small business to comply with, given a very limited budget, typically small businesses are not the kind of organization that has the wherewithal to look at a massive regulatory regime and embrace it. But the greater amount of regulation that's in the system, the less competition there is. And the more you move towards almost the monopoly status, I mean, what we had 100 years ago with the breaking up of trusts and massive companies, where do we go from here? Because this is a unique period in history. We see the growth of government yet again in the context of crisis. We see, at least in the financial sector, the assets under management of your largest banks are now much larger than they were, anywhere from 20 to 60% bigger than they were at the beginning of the crisis. Massive consolidation of influence, the too big to fails, are now even bigger. This is interesting because we don't have government pounding the pavement like they were 100 years ago with the antitrust legislation to sort of equalize and create opportunity for small enterprises. Breaking up the trust, obviously, was not just about giving entrepreneurs opportunity, but this is interesting. We have fascism, major businesses. Maybe you can explore some of these ideas. Where do you see us going from here? Greater cooperation, greater participatory fascism, or ultimately a breaking up and fractionalizing, if you will, of the system?
Well, my best guess, and that's all it can be, frankly, because no one knows the future. I'll just state that flatly. No one knows the future, and we all use what we consider our understanding of the past to help us make rough guesses about the future. But in doing that, my best guess is that in this country, and probably in European countries as well, we'll see a continued development of this corporatist arrangement. We'll see probably further consolidation. Certainly, as you say, we've had a substantial financial consolidation as a result of this crisis. And I would add that even antitrust law historically was in large part a device businesses used to shield themselves from competition, because very often big firms could be highly competitive and have grown big because they were good competitors. And their rivals and markets could use antitrust law against them sometimes just as a way of knocking them down when they couldn't beat them in the market. But in all events, what we have right now is a system that in large part is on autopilot because of the entitlements part of the government's budget at all levels of government. And so we've got this looming crisis, which anybody who knows arithmetic can see, because the government has promised more future benefits to people than can possibly be paid. And what can't be done will not be done. And the question is how governments will wriggle out of these obligations and what kind of havoc they will wreak in the process of doing so. Because, of course, politicians are extremely loath to give up any kind of power, and they get power in large part from trading the promise of benefits to people in exchange for political support. And so they will be very reluctant to cut back these benefits under Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security and other elements of the big state. At the same time, in this country, there's a strong set of interests that coalesce in favoring a gigantic military apparatus and U.S. military political involvement all over the world, which is very expensive and also gets this country into trouble in every dimension, economic, political, you name it. So you combine these two, the kind of welfare state end of the big state.
And the warfare state.
And the warfare state end of it. And you get an apparatus that is sucking resources out of the private sector and weakening the private sector by doing so. and sufficiently beholden to the private sector through fascism and cozy capitalism that it continually protects big entrenched incumbent firms against up-and-coming innovative rivals in markets, that my guess is that we're most likely to see a kind of a stagflation developing in the future. We'll probably have, because of the government's unwillingness to tax enough to pay its bills, this continued borrowing and buildup of state debt, and we will continue to see too much government involvement in every market, and there's going to ultimately, there has already been, in fact, a resort to the Federal Reserve System to make up the difference when the government finds it difficult to market its debt.
In other words, the Fed is just providing liquidity.
Yes, it's monetizing directly. In fact, now, because the Fed is just outright buying long-term government bonds. It bought a huge amount of them in the past 3 years. So this is like the government basically printing cash and paying its bills.
Right.
What it amounts to. And so far, we've been fortunate that this hasn't generated a high rate of inflation, because there's been so much apprehension in the past 3 or 4 years about economic and financial conditions that people have greatly increased their demand to hold money instead of spending it at the same rate they were previously. But when people get past their fears sufficiently that they don't want to hold so much cash as they are right now, then we will start to see more pressures for price increases across the board.
See, you're really talking about the velocity of money, where
yes.
the footprint of a dollar,
exactly.
It's, whether it's individuals or banks, they're
right.
just keeping the liquidity on the sideline,
right.
and it's not going through the economy.
We've got $1.5 trillion sitting in excess reserves in the banking system right now, which is just, you know, if you'd told somebody 5 years ago this was going to happen, they would have thought you were nuts. But that's what we have, and yet we haven't had hyperinflation.
Now, you've done the math on this, I'm sure. I mean, it's always interesting to me. I mean, I don't have a PhD in economics from Johns Hopkins. It would be an interesting course of study. But you look at that one figure, $1.5 trillion in excess reserves. If you put that into the economy and assumed a healthy velocity, not an extreme velocity, what is the inflationary impact of $1.5 trillion into the economy as it gets churned over at least a few times?
It's enormous. I mean, I don't have a kind of precise workout of that, but it would certainly result in hyperinflation. I mean, we would have at least a 100% rate of inflation. There's no doubt about it if you just suddenly threw that amount of additional purchasing power at the available goods and services.
This is precisely where our conversation has gone in the past. It's like the Hoover Dam. The liquidity exists behind the dam. Because the water is only coming out at a trickle, we're counting on the integrity of the bulwark. We're counting on that liquidity being held back. And yet, frankly, that's not why the liquidity, in the case of the $1.5 trillion, was created. It was created to be in the system, and it's not there yet. So what appears to be very tame inflation can change very rapidly. How rapidly do you think it can change?
Well, you know, I really don't know, because we've never been in this situation before. If you listen to Chairman Bernanke explain how he imagines his exit strategy working, he speaks very calmly, as if this were no big deal, that we will be able to handle this by using reverse repos and by open market operations and by just letting some of our portfolio mature and what have you. But this is all whistling past the graveyard, in my view. If the banks really decide to start lending seriously, I don't think there's anything the Fed can do to contain it that wouldn't result in drastically raising interest rates. And that, of course, is not going to be politically viable, because the politicians will scream bloody murder if the Fed allows interest rates to run up very much.
Well, it's not only not politically viable, it's also not economically viable.
That too.
We've got our average interest rate right now is 2.18% on the national debt, and we're shrinking our maturities. We're now less than 60 months in terms of the average maturity, and facing what could be, not tomorrow, but certainly within the next 24 to 36 months, the same kind of point of crisis that we saw in Europe this last fall, with an inability for national interests, sovereign entities, to roll over their debt. Yeah. That was the introduction of the LTRO, the long-term refinancing operation, to smooth that over. And no one thinks of the Treasury market as being anything but the definition of strength.
Those days are over, I think. In fact, I'm sure they are. And if we had our little bug inside the boardrooms in China where they're talking about the fact that they're holding $1 trillion in treasury, we would see that they're not letting a day pass without thinking about how they can pressure the U.S. to behave more responsibly. And if you think about what I just said, that's rather extraordinary, isn't it? Got ourselves in a situation where the Chinese are very worried about the irresponsibility of the U.S. government.
Well, and here's the interesting thing, because it's often said when you're talking about creditor and debtor relationships, if you have a little loan, the bank's in control. Yeah. If you have a big loan, you're in control. The problem is it's not just the existing debt that we have with the Chinese, it's the need to continually finance our operations. Yeah. Because, as you've said, we've promised too much. In the name of politics, we have overpromised constituency groups, they're part of the tax take, and actually that has to be financed every year by someone else. So we'd like to think that because of this massive stock of loans that have been given to us from the Chinese, that maybe we're in control. If we default, it could kill them, when in fact we still need them because we're not done with the financing.
And they still need us. The reason they got all that debt was by manipulating their currency to stimulate their exports, which they still want to do. So everybody's sort of tied in a Gordian knot together here, as between the Chinese, the Japanese, the U.S., and some of the Arab states, which financially are the big boys on the block that are rolling over debt constantly in huge amounts and keeping the Treasury going and allowing it to increase its debt. Now, what I think is going to happen, because it's happening now, is that the Fed is going to have to ride in a bigger and bigger way to rescue the Treasury. And I don't think it can continue to do that very much longer with and still contain price inflation.
Let's go back to our original topic. And this is of concern because, I mean, obviously we do have that knot which you're describing. Will it be untied or will it have to be cut? And who will cut it? The Chinese? Will it be petrodollar and a petrodollar crisis this summer? We don't know. When we go back to the current administration, this is just a thought experiment. No one knows who will win the next election. But if Obama were to have an extra 4 years, does he reflect for you, comparatively, to Roosevelt, to LBJ, to Truman? How does he stand up, and what would you expect in terms of, again, we've seen two pieces of legislation, certainly not the 40 pieces of legislation that were enacted between 1933 and 1940, but actually we burned a lot of paper with just with those two pieces of legislation. It may have actually been the equivalent of the 40. What do you think the next 4 years looks like? Is it a Roosevelt style? Is it a Truman style? Give us some historical perspective.
I know that Obama would like to be FDR in his first term. But it's not going to happen. As you say, he did manage to get Obamacare and the Dodd-Frank law, which by themselves create enormous mischief and uncertainty in the economy because of their requirements for so much administrative rulemaking. But it's still not comparable to what happened during Roosevelt's first term. I think what we might expect to see if Obama is reelected is something more akin to Roosevelt's second term, in which the New Deal played out, opposition rose, there was more difficulty in the economy, we had the Depression of 37-38, when we weren't yet recovered from the Depression that started in 29. So I really think that my best guess is for something like the 1970s, stagflation, slow real growth, probably enough inflation to be troublesome, and possibly much more than that. But as I said, we've never been in a situation truly comparable to the one we're in now. So as far as making economic forecasts, I really believe that we're in uncharted waters.
Well, any suggestions, sage advice, as both an academic, but also just as a man who has to look to his own balance sheet and take care of his own family, what's your sense of things? How would you conduct your affairs in this environment? It's uncharted territory. I mean, we still have to make choices.
Absolutely. Everybody's got to make his best guess and act on the basis of it. I never give financial advice, so you know, I wouldn't want anyone to think I'm doing that now. And that's because I really don't know. What I'm doing is trying to protect myself against possible high inflation. I have some inflation-protected assets. But I think a lot of people, and I'm doing the same thing, are holding real assets. Land is one of the things that may be some insurance. Commodities, of course, have attracted a lot of interest in the last few years, for the same reason that people are looking for some place to get a positive real return, which most of the financial instruments right now are not offering. And I'm also planning to leave this country because I think it's rapidly becoming a police state, and I don't want to be a victim of that state when it grows worse than it is already.
Well, I just heard the question ring in 1,000 listeners' minds, and where do you go?
Well, where I'm going wouldn't be a good place for everybody. I'm going to a very remote village in Mexico, hoping that once there, I will be off of everybody's radar screen.
My folks live in the Philippines much of the year. It's not unfamiliar to us, out-of-the-way places. But yeah, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and your comments. Let me come back around to these two books. That's my exposure to you, Crisis and Leviathan, and Depression War and Cold War. Where should people find your works? How can they be more familiar with your thinking, your writing? You've done a tremendous service to us in terms of your scholarship and the distillation of information. So where can they find you?
If you go to independent.org, which is the website for the Independent Institute, you'll find, with a couple of clicks, a page for me there. And it has links to many of my writings over the past 30 years or so, and links to my books, and many of my books are for sale there. And, of
Good.
Course, they can also be purchased from normal outlets such as Amazon.
You know, what I found is I started with what I thought were the most important chapters of your book, and I had selected about half of them, and I couldn't stop reading. So they were all too important to leave out. And so I really enjoyed Crisis and Leviathan, some very, very thoughtful reflections. There's a combination, and I gravitate, I think, towards people who think on an interdisciplinary basis. So your formal training in economics does not limit the dialogue to something as boring, for instance, as econometric modeling. You know, you're going well beyond that, and I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, and I'll just add that I do have a new book just coming out right now called Delusions of Power, and this reflects my latest thinking. It all has been put together in the past few years, and so if someone wants to get past my previous work, which in some cases goes back for some years, they can dip into Delusions of Power.
Well, I would encourage folks to do that, and there's probably a conversation we need to have in the future unpacking some of its content.
Very well.
Robert, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, David, just as I thought, that was a fascinating interview. You know, you listen to guys like Robert Higgs, who are well accepted in the academic community. The first book that you had me read was actually published by Oxford University Press, which they don't publish just anybody's books. This is a book full of excellent research. But what I thought was interesting is, after all this research, he's coming to a lot of the same conclusions that we have been, and that is, hold on to your assets. And maybe get something out of the country. I mean, what's your thought on what he was saying to do to protect yourself?
Well, Kevin, looking at stagflation and slow growth, looking at high probability of inflation, if not superinflation or hyperinflation, on the basis of those released excess reserves from the banking system, the central banking system, these things, yes, they've been a part of our conversations now for several years, but it's nice as market practitioners to see the academic community say, we don't see it any other way.
Yeah.
The math is now adding, the calculus is such that it's almost a foregone conclusion. I think probably most sobering to me is someone who's very measured in their decisions and very reasoned in their decisions leaving the country. Frankly, that's a staggering conclusion.
Sort of sobering, wasn't it?
Kevin, I personally would probably come to a different conclusion on that front, but I think there are ways in which you can have other options, and a part of that is diversifying your holdings outside of the United States.
So you don't have to live outside of the United States, but having something outside of the borders, like we talked about last week, whatever country you live in, you need to have something a little bit elsewhere so that if you have to do a restart, you can.
Exactly. And of course, compliance and dotting your I's and crossing your T's is utterly vital. But we think that having up to 25% of your liquid assets outside of your home country, and again, that can be any home country, that just makes practical sense. As we look at sort of a fiscal train wreck ahead of us, even more so, and as we see this natural propensity for the state to become coercive, by nature, that is the nature of the state, as Robert Higgs has pointed out. We think, yes, it makes sense to be smart about where you have your assets.
Well, I'm looking forward to reading his new book, Delusions of Power, as well. That will be probably much more current than like Crisis and Leviathan, which has been written, you know, well over a decade ago. You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call. 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.